Around Australia. Here's Inside Motorsport.
And good evening once again for another weekend's activities with Inside Motorsport. As it's been happening all around the world this week, we've had launches in Formula One, we've had launches in the Australian V8 supercar categories, we've had launches all over the place, and lots of activity happening. This weekend, of course, we've got drag racing taking place down at Calder Park Raceway down in Victoria. We also have the Rolex 24-hour race occurring over in the United States, where at the six-hour mark, the Cadillac was the surprise leader of the Daytona 24 Hours. The number 5 North Star LMP of Max Angeli, Wayne Taylor and Eric Vanderpoel led the day-night enduro by the best part of a lap from Rob Dyson's Riley and Scott Mark III. So things looking very interesting there over there in the Rolex 24 Hours. I'm actually trying to get hold of Daytona Speedway to get some more information on what's happening over there. But of course, as always, things Formula One this time of the year. Formula One dominates, and it's good evening to our guru of Formula One, the compiler of the world championship statistics from the Autosport Grand Prix Review 99, our very own Rory Gordon. Good evening to you, Rory.
Good evening, Colin. Oh dear.
The man's blushing in stereo.
Oh dear, yes. Not only are my cheeks blushing, the ball patch on top of my head going a lovely dark red as well. Gee, thank you for that, Colin.
Going Ferrari red, are we?
Oh, no. We're going much redder than that. Besides which, Ferrari red isn't red. It's orange.
Yeah, Marlboro orange. Fag packet orange.
Well, it shows, you know, in life it's orange, but on the TV it's red, and then there's Marlboro packet red, and, oh, dear, let's leave it.
But, of course, one of the big launches in the recent week was, of course, the launch of the Jaguar, and what has been, I think, probably one of the more attractive colour schemes to come out in Formula 1 for a number of years.
Well, having just said, okay, let's leave colour well alone, I'm going to have to loop back on this one. I don't think you've seen the final colour on the Jaguar. I don't think that the colour that was at the launch is necessarily going to be the colour that the cars will actually race in. They're trying to race in a sort of British racing green, to be patriotic and so forth, but they've got to get the right colour to show up on the TV just right, and they've actually tried something like 13 or 14 different hues of green to just get the right colour on TV. So it's not just a simple matter of, hey, look, let's paint it British Racing Green and send it out there. It's a matter of getting the right colour for the TV so that the sponsors like it and people can distinguish it and it doesn't blur and everything like this. And of course, there's another factor they're throwing, is that green is one of the colours, I'm not too technical on this, but I believe green is one of the colours that they use in television to put things on a backdrop screen as well. So it can't come too close to that, otherwise it's going to clash and it could throw up all sorts of problems. So they've got, quite aside from the mechanical and the aerodynamic and the drivers and everything else, they've also got their colour scheme to worry about. Interesting problem.
Well, at least it's one of the smaller problems I worry about. Actually, I think they call it chroma key, which is the effect where that, for example, I did at Bathurst for the 2 litre race last couple of years, they can actually overlay advertising, like virtual signposts and virtual signage on the actual racetrack itself. And if you get too close to that colour, yeah, all of a sudden the signage runs over the car rather than the car running over the signage.
Could lead to some very interesting effects. I mean, can you imagine Murray sitting there talking and then saying, oh, hang on, where have the Jaguars gone? They've disappeared.
Yep, they're just hiding under the advertising. Yeah. Yeah.
But very interesting.
We're down to a very short time frame before Murray will be giving those famous words, you know, here we are for the start of the 2000 season at Melbourne. But, of course, there's lots of bits and pieces going on this time of year, a lot of oddities and bits and pieces. Would you like to tell us what's happening out there?
Well, most of the cars have now launched, which, let's face it, is basically a public relations exercise. The car that you see is probably going to be fairly close to the car that actually gets out on the car you see at the launch is going to be fairly close to the car you get on the circuit, but there's no guarantee. But they've had their launches, and some of them have been in very exotic places, and some of them have been in very mundane places. McLaren, for instance, did their launch down at the test track, so you know, nothing really special. There's still a few launches to come amongst them, Ferrari, but I think we can fairly safely say that the car's going to be red or orange. So I think, and we know who the drivers are there, so that's not going to be a major thing. The interesting thing that's come out of it, the launches so far for me, has been to look at the cars and see two things that I think are going to be very interesting in terms of how they change during the season. Not so much the first one, which is the nose angle. There's been a trend over the last few seasons for noses to be either down or up. But it looks as though this season we're going to get a variety of noses at various angles. So that could be quite interesting to look at. I don't see that a car's going to change in that area very much. But where they might change is in the shape of the airbox. Now, the interesting one for me was the recent launch of the Jordan, which, to my eye, has a very triangular airbox. Now, other cars have, as you might remember, Jordan in past years has had a very oval airbox shape and so on. So I think that could be a place where some developments could happen as the season goes on that will be very noticeable and very easy to see for people who are, for instance, watching on TV.
Yeah, I noticed, you know, sort of going over the various cars, looking at the photos of the cars that have been released, the Williams, BMW Williams has sort of got an oval triangular intake, very much similar to what the Jaguar's running. The Benetton's got more of a rounded, yeah, and of course then you look at the BAR, very, very rounded. But then of course, yeah, Jordan with this very triangular, but it looks sort of as if they've done a little bit of work with some of the aerodynamics around that actual intake area, because you look at the step back from where the intake actually is, the actual rest of the airbox steps down much more sharply than some of the other cars.
Yeah, I'm sure, well, I'm not sure, but I'd hazard a guess at saying that is partly due to the triangular shape as, you know, the step has led to the triangle, or the triangle has led to the step, and there must be some aerodynamic effect in that little tunnel there. So it's going to be interesting to see what the designers do through the season, and whether they all end up at the end of the season using one particular design, or whether we start with this variety. And of course, it does depend too on the engine that each team's using. And I can't recall, except perhaps the last season, when we've had such a wide variety of engines. It's almost that every team has a different engine of some variety. Admittedly, Sauber, for example, are using an old Ferrari engine, but they're not using the new Ferrari engine, and so on and so forth. So it's virtually, I think, every team is using its own, in inverted commas, engine this year, which makes for something which I think is fairly novel.
Because, again, the catch being that Benetton badge their Supertechs as Playlife, where Arrows will use them as Supertechs.
Indeed.
So they make it even more confusing. It's the same engine, but a different nameplate on it.
Same engine, different name, you know. And, I mean, as we said, the Saubers are using Petronas engines, which, of course, are just last year's Ferrari engines. Minardi are reportedly going to be using Minardi engines, which are, in fact, last year's Ford engines. So it all gets quite complicated and quite difficult, and probably the simplest and easiest way is just to refer to them as the team, refer to them by their own name. So try and keep it simple.
Yeah. And of course, one of the teams that has yet to launch is Minardi. They've got their launch on the 16th of February in Spain. Now, of course, the thing that's open there is the second driver alongside Marc Higgin. They've yet to announce.
Well, that's I think that's going to be a combination of two factors as to who drives. And in fact, I think it's the only spot left available on the grid after we had the announcement in the last couple of weeks that Jos, Mr. Crash, Verstappen, will be driving for Arrows. It's who's going to be driving for Minardi. Two factors I think will come in there. One will be driver ability. Well, we certainly hope so. And the other one will be the amount of cash that they can bring to Minardi. And there's been quite a lot of discussion and debate about this, with no real conclusion. I've put a list together myself a few weeks ago of the people who have been mentioned as being possible for this, and I came up with a list of 12 names, and I won't even start going into them, but it just shows you how wide open that particular seat is, and I'm sure that hopefully at the launch we'll see who that driver is. The other driver change to mention is, of course, that not necessarily of course, is at Williams. Last season you'll recall at Williams they had Ralf Schumacher, who was, if not my driver of the season, was certainly number two. But they had Zanardi as well. Now, Zanardi, up until a few weeks ago, looked as though he was wobbly, but secure at Williams for this season. Not so. He's been paid to sit on the sidelines this year's season and do next to nothing, which I must admit, it's very tempting, you know, getting paid all that money to be a bum. I think that's a career development for me there. But they've brought in, Williams have brought in one of the youngest, if not the youngest driver, if he actually does take the grid, in Melbourne, ever to be in Formula One, a young Briton by the name of Jenson Button, which I'm sure is going to lead to a number of jokes of such things as cute as a button and things like that. Oh dear me, that was bad. But it's going to be very interesting. He's come from nowhere. He hasn't had a test contract or anything. So to see how he goes, suddenly being vaulted into Formula One, is going to be very interesting indeed. And it's also going to be interesting to see how Ralf Schumacher develops as, I dread to say this, as a father figure to him, because effectively that's what he's going to have to be. I hope that Ralf takes it on in the right manner, because last season he surprised me and ended up as one of my two best drivers, so it could be very interesting both ways. I don't think Button will necessarily be challenging for the title, and I don't think Williams will either. But see whether the development of the relationship between Schumacher and Button will be very interesting indeed.
Yeah, very interesting to know as well that world champion Mika Häkkinen had given a bit of a warning that Jenson Button could face a Formula One nightmare for the next few years. Purely, you know, the young man's thrown in at the deep end, and it really could be a case of he's going to get a lot of, you know, a lot of expectations placed on him, and the fact that as well Williams is in that sort of learning period with their new BMW engine, so there's going to be a lot heaped on him.
There is an aspect to that that someone mentioned to me a few weeks ago, which I never thought of. I'm not a conspiracy theorist, but it's another of these conspiracy theories that Jenson Button has been thrown in because Williams know that this season is, with the BMW engine, is going to be a development season. He's been thrown at the deep end, and he's going to be given the flick in a couple of years when another driver, probably paid for by BMW, is brought in to replace him. And, you know, it's going to be a big name driver.
A big name German driver?
Well, take your pick. But certainly there's a possibility there. The Button would be being young, and not having any kudos attached to him, I think would be much easier to get rid of than, say, a Zanardi after he's been there for three or four seasons. Even if he's done nothing, he would have settled in and know how everything runs. It'd be much easier to get rid of a young guy who's got inexperience, and let's face it, he's not expected to get any results. So it'd be much easier to get rid of him, and perhaps, as you say, bring in a certain German driver so that there's a really sort of Anglo-German team.
Well, Rory, that's where we'll leave it for this evening to move on to other things. No doubt we'll catch up with you in the next few weeks as we continue the countdown to the start of the 2000 Formula One season in Melbourne.
Indeed, Colin, and I'll look forward to speaking to you next time.
And one thing I'll mention now, my spies over in England tell me that this year's most collectible, desirable items will, of course, be those items coming from the Jaguar team. Cue up now. How to spend money in a big way, he said.
Oh, yes. I think I could do that quite easily. I think the Jaguar logo is just the Jaguar, and the green, it's almost as evocative as the Ferrari and the prancing horse. And in fact, to me, as a Briton, it's probably more evocative than it is than the Ferrari and the Ferrari red and the prancing horse. So I'm afraid to say that I'll be one of those mugs in that market.
Okay, Rory, thank you this evening.
Good night.
Good night.
Well, after the disappointment of a fortnight ago where the NASCARs didn't make it out onto the track, Neville Wilkinson, you're returning to us with some great news.
Well, yeah, supposedly, well, it is all going Western Australia. I mean, this is the first time the NASCARs have raced outside of the Thunderdome for a little while now. I mean, okay, Bathurst and all that kind of stuff, but you know, this is like the heady days of Oran Park and in New South Wales, even at Eastern Creek before Oran Park. So yeah, supposedly 21 to 25 cars are going to be racing around Barbagallo Raceway, and it's going to be quite interesting because we know the NASCARs do not like to stop, and it's a braking track.
Yes, and also they're pretty heavy on tyres, and I believe that's the number one concern so far of all the competitors.
Well, yes, reports are coming in, but I can't, none of them have really been confirmed, but they've got some tyre problems. I mean, supposedly Kim Jane went out and tested tyres the other day at Calder, the tyres that the competitors were going to use, and there is a tyre rule, and the tyres, well, they're saying they hardly did 5 laps around Calder, so they're not really going to do 5 laps around Barbagallo. So, I mean, the competitors said, oh, hang on, we're not going to use those tyres, we're going to probably give you some different ones, ones that last. But that's the main concern. Okay, tyres is tyres, but the main concern is the brakes. I mean, some people think don't even know if they're going to last 2 laps before they're going to bury them in the sand pit, so, or the sand traps, and they're going to be dragging them out of the sand all weekend. So it could be quite interesting, especially coming down that downhill into that right-hander before you go on the start finish straight. It should be quite interesting.
Now, will they be running on the full Barbagallo circuit, or will they be running on a modification of that circuit?
Not too sure. My guess is it's a modification because, I mean, NASCARs tend to be more exciting on a shorter circuit than a long circuit anyway because of the style of car they are. I mean, when they went to Eastern Creek, they ran on the short circuit, you know, other than the long circuit. And the same with Oran Park.
Yeah,
I mean,
they
ran on the short circuit there.
They're fantastic on the short circuit, and the Oscars also put on fantastic racing.
That's right. They don't need a long circuit to be good. So, I'm not too sure. My guess is, because it has to be, as far as I know, there's going to be some of it under light, so I'm assuming it's a short circuit.
Mm-hmm. All right. Now, Oscars going along to support the bill there, or
no,
there's going to be a
NASCARs.
NASCARs and a Western Australian support then?
Correct.
Oh, so it is going to be an interesting night's racing, to say the very least.
Well, no one's had a mix like this since Oscar's race at the Peter Brock Classic. Remember that all those years ago? And they had nearly every class under the sun. Well, I mean, we're going to have sports sedans, I assume, are going to be racing at West Australia with NASCARs, basically, on the same program.
It is going to be an interesting one. And one interesting thing coming out of the NASCARs is that, the closure of that meeting at Calder Park, this meeting, not being run by Calder Park Management, it is being run by Barbagallo almost solely.
Well, yes, I mean, the gentleman over there, I can't remember his name at the moment, it eludes me, but Barry Blake, he's kind of like put up a bit of his own money to get these guys over there because they've all been given tow money to get their cars over there because it's not cheap to get your cars over to Perth. And so, you know, Barry Blake's put up a bit of his own money and got a group together to put this on. Obviously, Calder Park do have some involvement, but they're the sanctioning body. That's just about it.
This might be able to resurrect the NASCAR's group somewhat.
Well, definitely. I mean, the promoters of this event are obviously hoping for a good crowd, and I understand that they're advertising, well, to put it in a better term, they're advertising the crap out of it over there, so hopefully the crowd's going to go along and support it and see some good NASCAR racing. It'll obviously be exciting because I'm sure there's going to be a few offs.
Yes. Well, Neville, we're going to be looking forward to getting all the results from Barbagallo, and a Saturday night meeting is going to give us all the opportunity to talk about it next week.
Most definitely.
Thanks very much, Neville Wilkinson.
See you, Craig.
Yeah, thanks, Neville Wilkinson there. And just to return to the story we opened with this evening regarding the Daytona 24 hours at the 6-hour mark, the positions as they stood on the track were in first position, leading by just over a lap, was the Cadillac North Star of Vanderpoel, Taylor Angeli. And second was the Riley and Scott of Dyson, Forbes, Robinson, Weaver and Pappas. And then we find Beretta, Wendling and Dupuy in a Dodge Viper third. They're asking some five laps down. Collins, Freon, Pilgrim, a Chevrolet Corvette, third lap down and fourth. Archer, Duez, Voss, and a Wrecker, Chrysler, Viper, GDSR, and third lap down in fifth. Donahue, Billock and Ameren, another Dodge Viper. Bit of a Dodge Viper benefit there up the top end. They're sitting another lap behind in sixth. In seventh, Bell, Fellows and Neifel in a Chevrolet Corvette. Eighth, Conrad Lammers and Masson and Ford Lola. And ninth, the first of the Porsche GTE3Rs of Huseman, Huseman and Law. And tenth, Conti, Labatt and Pobston, another of the Porsche GT3Rs in the GTU class. So in the GTU class, it's basically the Porsches. In the GTOs, it's the Dodge Vipers currently leading. A number of the prototypes having problems, some early accidents and usual problems with lapping slower cars. So things looking quite interesting over there in Daytona, so we're trying to get hold of them. As well, testing for the 2000 kart series has been running at Sebring on Friday. The new kart team, Mo Nun Racing, hit track for the first time in testing at Sebring, and driving a Raynard Mercedes, Tony Canown set at the 12th fastest time of the day, a 51.9 second lap. A new team, new car, get anything bedded down, so that's interesting to see how things go there. But in terms of the Sebring testing times during the course of the testing so far, fastest has been Christian Fittipaldi for the Newman Haas team in the Lola Ford at a 50.3 second lap, with Cristiano DiMatta for the PPI team in a Raynard Toyota. Actually, very interesting to notice that Raynard Toyota and the Toyota engines coming much further up the grid than what they were a couple of years ago, 50.8 seconds. Juan Montoya in the Ganassi team with the new Lola Toyota combination there, replacing the Raynard Honda combination, 50.9 seconds. Helio Castroneves in the Penske now moving over to a Raynard chassis with a Honda engine. Their big break from having Penske chassis and Mercedes engines, a 50.9 second lap. Richie Hearn for Delapena Racing in the Raynard Toyota, 51 seconds even. Max Pappas for Team Rahal in the Raynard Ford, 51.1. Jimmy Bass is sitting 7th fastest of the test so far, again for Ganassi and the Lola Toyota, 51.1 seconds. And Alex Tagliani in the Players Forsyth team, the Renault Ford, 51.3. Interesting to see there, we've got to go down a fair way for some of the other drivers. Dario Franchitti, Team Cool Green, Renault Honda, 52.3 second. And Paul Tracy, no time recorded. That's just what he needs. Actually, Shinji Nakano for Walker, Renault Honda, sitting 15th fastest in the test so far. Of course, that's over the total time of testing. The other interesting story this week come out from overseas. It's reigning British Touring Car Champion Laurent Aiello will join the new DTM series, teaming up with Apt Sportslime Audi team. We'll be racing Audi TTs in the championship. Dimensions of TT didn't make the series regulations, but they've had a special dispensation for the 2000 season to get themselves going there. So it's going to be interesting to see how Laurent Aiello steps in to the new DTM. Actually, it's looking like it could be interesting series. It's got a lot of teams, a lot of drivers, a lot of cars coming in, so we'll see how it all goes there. Now, joining us on the other side of the panel is Craig Revell and
Tony Thornton. And Tony, we're getting ready to the busy end of the season with Adelaide in there.
Hello, Tony, can you hear us?
Yes, I can.
Okay, you can obviously hear me, so you might be having some problems with the microphone that Craig's using, so we'll try a different microphone.
And just see, okay.
Can you hear Craig now?
Hello, are you there, Tony?
Yes, Craig.
All right, everything's getting set now for a big year. We're getting to the big end of the season with Adelaide coming up next weekend and the Nationals right on the weekend after it.
Yeah, it's certainly a big... The Nationals is normally in March, but due to the Olympics, which has had an effect on everybody, we've got the Southern football season starting a month early, so we wanted to get the Nationals in before that.
And with all the things going on this year. You next weekend meet with the Andra bodies from around Australia to have round number one of the rules review.
That's right, Craig. The rules change in October every year, and a lot of people still getting used to what happened last October. There was nothing too radical. But what happens is that from around September to the end of January, we invite submissions from anyone who wishes to put them forward, certainly the racers and the people who run the tracks and things, but also sponsors, and if any of the fans out there are interested in making a suggestion. We can't come up with all the good ideas on our own. They close at the end of January, we circulate them to everyone to read, and then the National Control Council meets in mid-February to consider all the submissions, and then we take out all the good ones, package them up, and put them out to the public for comment. Then we come back in April and make the decisions on what we'll be doing from October.
With that, we've already seen a few decisions that you've made in the past, decisions that have actually transferred over to the United States. With particularly
there's always a debate about that, because that there's people looking at things all the time. We'd like to think that some years ago, when Top Alcohol was emerging in Australia, and then later Top Door Slammer, because the number of cars is limited in Australia, we have to have a bigger combination of brackets than they do overseas, and we came up with some supercharge restrictions and weight brake balances that meant the classes worked. That's certainly still the case in Top Alcohol, and it's glad to see people looking at what we're doing.
With these two meetings coming up, it does involve a fairly hectic schedule for your Group 1 runners, having Adelaide and the Nationals back to back, but the Nationals once again getting oversubscribed and really showing the true strength of drag racing, even though we don't have a New South Wales market for regular competition.
Yeah, it sort of adds to the importance of the Nationals, I think, because certainly the Sydney guys like to be part of what's going on, and the two events that surround them, if you like, are the Winter Nationals to the north and the Nationals to the south. The Nationals is also the event to which a large swag of Western Australians come, making the trip right across the country. And it's interesting that the last time the Nationals were in Perth, which was around 10 years ago now, only 14 or 15 people from the rest of the country made the trip. Most years now, more Western Australians than that come to the Nationals on top of all the other guys.
And with that, of course, you really were saying off air to me, you do admire just how many of the Western Australians are getting on board and following the series now.
Well, you know, it's a 4,000 kilometre trip from Melbourne, and let's not even think about how far it is to Brisbane from Perth. And if you're towing a car, it takes a considerable amount of time. There's the cost of fuel and accommodation, and I just admire the heck out of the guys who make that effort, because on top of all that, you've got the normal pressures of racing, and the Nationals is not the easiest event in the world to have a good run at.
And of course, as you focus in on all of that, the plans for this meeting and for Adelaide and Calder Park, how have they been going together? Because obviously running two big events so close together, whilst it does cut down on a little bit of accommodation and travel, it does then mean that you've got two fairly big meetings back to back to try and prepare for.
Yeah, well, on the one hand, having the two events a week apart is a bit of a challenge, but then the other side of it is that it does make it a good opportunity for the guys from Perth to have a shot both ways. And also, I suppose a lot of people are using the Adelaide event as a test session, if you like. Certainly the Door Slammer drivers will be racing for points, and they'll be more anxious than ever to make a dent in the schedule now, because they lost the event at Willowbank a couple of weeks ago, the first round of the New Year series, and Dave Coop, who is from Adelaide and who is currently leading the Top Door Slammer points, actually missed his brother's wedding to make the Queensland trip, and there was no racing. So I don't know how he smoothed all that over, but I'm sure they'll all be at Adelaide looking to stay ahead in the points.
One thing we talked about at the beginning of the season, because the bane of summer sports so far this year has been rain, and we talked about looking at a venue providing a compulsory Monday to finish off the event.
Either that or a Sunday. But the problem with the Mondays, of course, it's very unlikely that any of the fans will be able to make it back. And that really adds to the cost of the event. Sunday is difficult enough because a lot of the competitors, given that they need to do a few interstate events and they need the Sunday to travel home, would probably think twice about staying around. But it used to be the exception, and now it's happening far too often, and it has a bad impact on the points chase for all the people concerned. It also is a problem for the tracks because while it's all very well to shut the gates, if you can get the event to happen at some point, the people who want their monthly dose of drag racing can get it.
What about holding an event normally, like with the Adelaide event backing up with the Nationals, you couldn't do it, but what about holding an event over till the following weekend? Is that something Andrew's considering?
It's difficult, Craig. If the event predominantly involves local people, then it's not that big an ask, but outside of probably a quarter of the Group 1 people, I don't think there are too many people who could, or from a racing point of view, who could do that too often because, and the other thing is, of course, that many of the tracks are booked up fairly solidly now, those that do other things apart from drag racing, like Melbourne and Adelaide. So I think week apart is a bit beyond us here, but certainly we need to do something to make sure that we can get the events completed if there's any chance at all in between things like bad weather or even curfews. I mean, if you have any serious oil downs or hold ups, it doesn't take much to move the clock past 11 o'clock, and most tracks have got to stop at that point.
Yeah, and as we talked about last time, it doesn't go too well having a championship decided on semi-final rounds or things like that. It just sort of takes a little bit of the gloss off.
There are too many instances where two or four people get the same points, and if they're neck and neck in the championship, it almost prolongs the agony. I mean, it's great to have the chase go right down to the wire, but you need a bit of excitement through the series.
Well, Tony, it's been a pleasure to catch up with you again, and we look forward to speaking to you as we roll through two big weeks of drag racing up and coming over the next fortnight.
Absolutely, and thank you for your interest, and we'll talk again soon.
We will do indeed. Tony Thornton there, the president of Andra.
Well, last weekend, as we mentioned, Robbie Buell took the victory in the first IRL race of 2000. Not bad for a team that had only started at Christmas.
You know, we were actually on the teleconference. I don't know, how long was that ago? 3 weeks ago?
Just 2 weeks ago,
kind of announcing that. So to have this kind of result, you know, that's exciting and definitely exceeds what expectations are. But we knew we had a good group of guys put together behind the scenes. Mitch Davis and the guys have been with him, John O'Gara's crew chief. I felt pretty good about that. But the first time we went out with the car, we didn't have any hiccups. I was very happy with the balance of it. It felt as though every change that we made, it did what we wanted. We kept improving on the race car, and, you know, at that time, every time we go out with the car, we got more excited about what we felt we could do with it.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, as the rain came through the race weekend and we didn't get to qualify, you know, we would like to start it up a little bit higher, but everything worked out, so that's great.
Well, with a new team in particular, you were on the teleconference about 2 weeks ago and sounding very confident. When did you really think that this team could win it?
I don't know if I'd say that, but, you know, I was very happy with the way everything was taking shape. When we last talked, I hadn't been in the car yet. But the fact that, you know, we got a new car, we got it painted, we got everything done in the period we did, you know, Purex is very happy with the way everything's coming together. Dennis Reinbolt and Eric DeBoer, my two partners, all of us are kind of, you know, everything's been going too smooth and too easy, and you keep waiting for a hiccup. But I think that just part of why that is I think we all know what our responsibilities are, and we all look to take care of those areas. Yeah, I was confident. You know, you're always doing everything you can to win, but you always need some things to go your way. We definitely had a race car capable of winning. It's just a matter of putting yourself in that position, and sure enough, some things went our way towards the end of that race to allow us to do that.
about the new sponsor in Pyrrell, or Pyrex, sorry. They would have been over the moon with a win in a first-up effort.
Well, no, they couldn't have been happier. We had, we actually had gone out to dinner with some of those guys on Friday night, and they were all very excited to begin with, but then they also came to the team celebration with us on Saturday night, so they're all very excited. Purex is owned by the Dow Corporation that's based in Phoenix, and the one brand manager of Purex, who we've done a lot of work with, he was pretty excited to go back to the office and, to show up in the office and kind of gloat, if you will, with regards to how things are going.
Okay, and of course things happening with the Indy Racing League. Next week, of course, starting on Thursday evening is the Swedish Rally. And once again, the Swedish Rally proves one of those great challenges for drivers who come from outside the Nordic countries. This year could see the opportunity for a bit of a surprise, because Thomas Redstrom, who's been dumped by Ford when Sainz joined Toyota, is back in a privately run Toyota Corolla World Rally car, and he stands a real good chance of being the joker in the pack. He's had a fair bit of success up there in the past, but of course four-time world champion Tony Mäkinen wants to go to the event, thinking that he's going to be the guy who's going to be hard to beat after his success in the Monte Carlo Rally. Naturally enough, the boys from Subaru, Burns and Kankinen, hope to be serious contenders there. No doubt you're Kankinen, one of those wily old boys of World Rally Championship. He's hoping to do his good things. Sayat drivers, Didi Ourel and Tony Gardemeister, hope that despite lack of experience of the car in those type of conditions, they can probably get some points there. And Peugeot, who had a Monte Carlo wipeout, hope that their cold start problems will be resolved and they'll be able to at least start the cars after the various sections. Ford, of course, Colin McRae, he's hoping things go better than him than what happened at Monte Carlo, where the car had its problems just before the finish of the event. And of course the Swedish Rally will see Hyundai entering the World Rally Championship with the new Accent World Rally car for the first time, with Kenneth Eriksson and Alistair McRae trying to do their best with a car that will be new to the championship. So it'll be very interesting to see how things go there. As I say, it starts next Thursday evening. They have a sort of a ceremonial start ramp ceremony, with the real action starting on Friday morning. And hopefully the conditions up there in Sweden will be better than what they have had. They were sort of sweating it out, if one could put it that way, until the last minute, because of the weather was not good enough. They weren't getting the level of snow and ice that they were hoping for, so definitely those guys are hoping for better things there. Of course, here in Australia, things have been happening big time in terms of the V8 supercars, with a number of livery launches and driver launches during this week. Stephen Ellery has made his appearance with his new super cheap auto Ford Falcon. The Tickford Ford Racing Team cars of Glenn Seaton and Neil Crompton, they've given their new look, which is sort of a bit of a merger of last year's look with the Ford Corporate Blue, with a bit of the Ford Credit scheme from a year or so ago. And the big one this week, of course, Brad Jones Racing, they've gone right out of the usual ballpark for motorsport, and they've signed up Aussie Mail Internet, Australia's leading internet provider, as their big sponsor. A bit of a toe in the water exercise for them, and of course, knowing Brad and Kim Jones, I'll be trying to give Aussie Mail Internet the maximum exposure with that car, and I'd say that knowing their preparation as well, they'll probably be doing very, very well.
Yes, and one interesting thing to come out of all those launches, next week we'll see the launch of John Faulkner Racing, and John Faulkner Racing having quite an interesting launch, which everyone should keep an eye out for, because he is going to be involving the Make-A-Wish Foundation in his campaign this year. So that one is one to look out for. I can't give away too many details there. But as the Jones boys go online, it's one of many sponsorship deals in motorsport that the internet is starting to come up with. The other one is $50 million being paid out by Northern Light to be the naming rights sponsor over 5 years for the Indy Racing League. It now will be known as the Northern Light Indy Racing League, and $50 million is quite a high price tag for any sort of internet company to provide. We also saw in the IRL's first event, Lycos, making a move there. Tickets.com are the major sponsor of Valencia Jr., who had a grin from ear to ear as he was seen passing people. He had with the rain out that they talked about in the IRL race, they had to start on championship points from the previous season. Of course, Gallus, Al Jr. and Gallus' team didn't race last season, so they're starting out of position 22. He's driven his way up to 8th place, and then eventually the engine let go, a big end let go on the engine. And, well, he was a happy camper because he was seen to be going forward again, and he said, any day you're passing people, it's a good day. And over his last couple of years, he didn't do too much passing.
Guarantees as well that the cameras will follow you, the person making the big moves from the back of the pack, and always gets lots of chat.
But Robbie Buell, once again, also in a brand new team, going from the back to the front, as we just heard there. Now, with those internet sponsors, Jones is the first one in Australia, but I think we could be seeing a bit of a trend, because certainly the internet is a great way of providing information. We get a lot of our information to keep you all up to date through different services on the internet. And, well, Jones, Northern Light, Lycos, Tickets.com, Monster.com was providing all the airship footage. Now, traditionally a mainstay of Goodyear, but with Goodyear's major pullout of motorsport, it was Monster.com that was doing the airship cameras for the events. So a very interesting one there.
Yep. I think we'll see too as well with the wind down of the tobacco sponsorship in a lot of the championships. BMW, Williams, they've already made the mark with Compaq and Nortel. We'll see more and more of the high technology that the NASDAQ companies coming in to be the major sponsors. Very interesting as well, noting in the Autosport Formula 1 review for 999, they had an article which marked the departure of Rothman / Winfield from motorsport sponsorship with the end of the 99 season, because now they've basically pulled themselves out completely from the top levels of motorsport. They'll do a little bit of sponsorship here and there, but effectively they've said, you know, we know where things are heading for the future. Time to sort of we'll pack up the bags and go out gracefully.
Mm-hmm.
So anyhow, that's where we're heading there.
Joining us online to have a look at the Speedway moving through New South Wales is Wade Auger. And Wade, a couple of interesting meetings being held right across New South Wales in Newcastle and, of course, at PCR.
Yeah, at PCR we had the New South Wales Super Sedan Championship, the Auto 1 New South Wales title. And Reverend Ron Pine has been winning everything that's not nailed down in the last couple of months. He won the All-Star Sedan 6th round at Parramatta a few weeks back, and well, he just backed it up with just a powerhouse drive last night to win his first ever New South Wales Super Sedan title. He, only a couple of weeks ago, successfully defended his Australian Championship. It's the first time in 29 years of AFCF Australian titles that someone has done that. So last night he was victorious, but by far the most exciting driver of the night was Michael G. The former Australian Leader Car champion from Toowoomba was just sensational. He came from the back of the field, eventually ran second. John Pine was placed in third. Michael Pope won the Leader Car main event, and the AMCA Nationals was won by Bernie Gordon. Up the road, Newcastle, Danny Smith, who had never driven a speed car before in his life, was subbed into the Bob Woods number 13 Fontana of the Steve Smith power plant, and subsequently did the job on Adam Clark, which many people find absolutely staggering, not because of, you know, Smith's not short on talent or anything like that, but to never have driven one before and go into Adam Clark's backyard and beat him. I believe Clark passed him with two laps to go, and Danny Smith was able to repass him and go on to win it, so that's quite incredible.
I tell you what, on the form Adam Clark was showing at the round of the speed car series at Parramatta last weekend, you would have thought he was untouchable. Stephen Graham had a go at him, but he drove away from him. The rest of the field had a go at Stephen Graham, and Graham managed to keep them off. But at every stage, Clark was pulling away.
Yeah, and you know, Clark is, and he was so clever. That was really, really the big thing. He was just so clever in on the slick track, and that's what he learned in America. None of the other drivers, except for Stephen Graham, had that kind of experience. So when the track does go that way, you know, that's when you see that bright green car clear out, and that's exactly what we saw. I believe that Stephen Graham and Mark Brown went down to Bacchus Marsh Speedway last night, so we didn't see them at Newcastle or Parramatta.
Yes, and they're getting ready, of course, for the non-NASA National Championships, which is the Australian Speed Car Control Council National Championships at Bacchus Marsh. Amazing thing about Bacchus Marsh, I reckon it's a very rocky track, so a lot of the drivers are going to be employing rock guards, which is the first time, I think, in 25 years that we'll see rock guards on speed cars. And also, Craig Brady was allegedly clocked at 220 kilometres per hour on Bacchus Marsh.
Really?
It was like, what's that, 180, 190 miles an hour? No, it wouldn't be that high.
No, no, it's about...
Where's my speed converter?
120, 130. That's it.
Yeah, miles per hour, yeah, that's right. But still, a very big speed, a very fast speedway, and a very big open speedway from what I'm led to believe.
Yeah, lots of room, very, very wide, so I'm sure that they'll get plenty of good cars for that. What I'm hearing is that everyone has had the hard compound tyres, but the track has been known to get pretty slick, so it'll be interesting to see who comes out on top on that one.
Yeah, that's right. We've got to focus our attention on one more big sprint car show this year. It comes up on the 12th of February, and that, of course, is the $50,000 live on C7 sprint car, and I'm not sure what the word goes with it. Sprint car classic? Sprint car?
It's a Goffin Gilmore Cat 50,000. And this is, the most significant sprint, well, it's definitely the most significant speedway race, I think, in Australian speedway history. $50,000 for the winner, 52 Aussies are nominated, 7 Americans and a Kiwi. And I think everybody's just dying to see what the likes of new Australian sprint car champion Gary Brazier will do. You know, people of that ilk for 50 grand. I mean, they raced, you know, unbelievably hard last night for 15. And now to, you know, to come to Parramatta next weekend, Friday and Saturday night, to run for 50. Wow. It's going to be something pretty special, let me tell you, Craig. Mm.
And, of course, a few Americans still hanging around for that one as well. They don't mind taking money off us.
Yeah, that's right. If the Australian title hadn't fallen between the 50,000 and the Classic, I think we would have seen even more. I think it's a bit ludicrous, really, that Americans aren't allowed to compete in the Australian Sprint Car Championship. You know, Knoxville this year, the Australian Knoxville Challenge, they pay $10,000 for the winner. The Americans are, you know, and live TV across America. So the Americans are doing the right thing, from what I believe. We're certainly allowed to run at the Knoxville Nationals, you know, in its entirety. So I just think it's a little bit... I know the argument has been in the past, well, you know, we don't care. If an American was to win it, we wouldn't get to promote the Australian champion for the next year. But that's not really the truth, because currently, you know, the guys like Gary Brazier, Kerry Madsen, Brooks Tatnall, Skip Jackson, that are always the contenders for this event, are generally in the States most of the year anyway, and then they come back and run World Series, so they really don't spend any time at home for any great length of time. So I think we've gone beyond that argument.
Well,
that's my point of view anyway.
It's funny that you bring this argument up, because the Speed Cars, about 5 years ago, had the closed shop on their national title.
Mm-hmm.
And they were arguing to get it changed to have an open slather, run what you'd run type thing if you're an American, Australian, Antarctican. You could run the national title. Because when you look at it, we had a situation, Stephen, well, this is back to 1988 when this argument started up. Stephen Gall wins the Australian Speed Car Championship at PCR. Moved up to sprint cars straight away.
Yep.
No Australian Speed Car Champion that year to promote. Then you had a situation, Phil March, and a number of other Australian Speed Car Champions moved up straight away, and you still didn't get to promote them. So the difference between an Australian Speed Car Champion moving on to sprint cars the year after he wins it, and an American going back home and taking the title with him, is about the same at the end of the day.
Well, this year Bob Holt won it and retired.
Yeah.
And the year before, Robbie Farr won it and hardly raced a meeting. In fact, I don't think he even raced a meeting as the Australian chair. He might have raced one. So, you know,
yeah.
I think, as you're saying, I think the you know, the old arguments are no longer relevant, and I think it's time that we sort of seriously considered it. That's only my opinion, but I know that guys like Danny Smith, you know, who have given enormous support to the Australian sprint car industry over 18 years, I think they deserve... You know?
Yeah, that's right. Danny Smith would have much preferred to be down there at Speedway City in South Australia than being in Newcastle, even though he took a win in Newcastle. He would have loved that result, but he would like to have had the opportunity, I'm sure, to run for the Australian Speed Car Championship.
Yeah, no question. Absolutely no doubt in my mind. But, you know, I don't think it's going to change in any great hurry, so we'll just have to go with what we have. But
All right, now... Yeah. For people getting ready for the 50,000 show, the Goffin Gilmore, I must ask you about Goffin Gilmore, sponsoring the Speed Car Series, sponsoring the 50,000 night at Parramatta.
Yep.
Really come on board in a big way with NASA's involvement there.
Yeah, they've been involved with Parramatta now for 4 years. They are the Caterpillar distributor for New South Wales and the ACT, and they've come on board and really thrown their weight behind it. But they're also very clever too. I mean, they're going to get significant exposure out of the event. I mean, it's been covered live on C7 Sport, as you said earlier, on the Austar network and Optus television as well. So they're going to get a fair bit from it. They're going to entertain 200 of their guests on both nights of the event, and hopefully get some excellent exposure out of it. So I think that they're going to get as much from it as we do.
Now, the V8 sedans, which we have the New South Wales titles on last night at Parramatta, they have also been contesting the series, which has seen Newcastle and up there in Queensland, Archerfield, both having their rounds. So when do we see the V8 super sedans?
Well, their next commitment will be at Newcastle, and I think it's around about the 26th, something like that. So, to be honest with you, I can't think offhand when we'll actually be running them next. I'm pretty sure it's the 26th. One thing I've been really enjoying is being able to keep tabs on the super sedan suit in Queensland in particular through the Foxtel show. And I noticed the other day that Avalon too sort of are starting to get involved sending some super sedan stuff in. So it's been good, but being able to sort of monitor progress of other circuits and other for the super sedan divisions, because I think they're on a bit of a crest of a wave. Although the Australian super sedan title in Tasmania, no one heard anything about it. If it wasn't for Ron Pine ringing the media up himself and telling people that he was he was the new Australian champion, no one would have really been able to find out.
I was looking for it on the internet, and you couldn't even get a contact, a contact us email, so that you could get a message down on saying, hey, I want to call you up, because it was a Sunday night affair.
Well, I mean, and I don't suppose you got a media list, did you? that's the most disappointing part of it, is that the event, the national titles deserve to be set aside from the mainstream competition, but in order to do that, we really have to get it there and make sure that someone's making it happen.
Well, Wade, it's been a pleasure, as always, to catch up with you, and we're looking forward to it as the sprint cars head east now. There was no doubt that everyone that was at Speedway City is going to be heading across. Danny Smith coming off a speed car win, and we know how all great speed car drivers turn into superb sprint car drivers.
Yes, there seems to be a trend in that direction, doesn't there? I mean, I'd like to see Adam Clark in a car, actually. It's a shame that can't happen. But maybe one day. Who knows?
All right, then.
Good to talk to you, Craig, anyway.
Thanks a lot, Wade Auger.
No.
And as Wade Auger leaves us there, we're joined now by Jim Reid. And Jim, looking forward to two big weeks of drag racing, the Top Fuelers off to the Nationals, and of course the Door Slammers before that have called a park to contend with, Adelaide to contend with, sorry.
Yes, that's correct, Craig, but I don't know a racer in the country who wouldn't be looking forward to going to Calder for the Nationals. It's one of the two events each year that just about everybody, busts their neck to be at, and spectators the same.
It has grown to over, I think, 500 cars entering into this year's event, and well, with you and the Gregory's Top Fueler out there, it's going to be a fantastic show right across the board. We just all cross our fingers, legs, whatever, to hopefully get three great weather days, which won't spoil any of the racing, which has really been a drawback for our summer season of motorsport.
Yes, it hasn't treated a lot of the sports real good at the moment, has it? One minute we've got damn rain, next minute we've got heat. And I'm sure Calder Park's going to be, the perfect weather this year. I just got a good gut feeling about it. We got beat to death at the last round down there in December with the rain. It hit us three or four times through the day. Like you said, there hasn't been a lot of quality racing over the summer period because of the weather, but let's hope the Nationals turns that all around for everybody.
With yourself, you being able to do much of the development work, putting a lot more new bits into the car to get ready for this one?
Yes, fortunately, it's given us a little bit of time to give a lot of things a bit of a rethink. Our major problem's been over the last two events is the car's making so much damn power out there in the middle of the racetrack, was picking the front end up at about 250 mile an hour, and we've just fitted all new modern front wings to the car now to bring it up to the latest spec, and I spent a bit of time in the States recently watching some of the cars running over there and taking a look at what the latest trends were, and I think right at this moment my main opponents, Charlie DeFilippo and Robin Kirby, I think they're actually at the Winter Nationals this weekend, so they'll be out there trying to learn a lot.
Yeah, up there at Pomona in California, which is the the kickoff of their season for the Winston Championship.
Yeah, well, that's correct. There's only one problem. Anyone who goes there to learn anything really isn't going to learn a lot, because they have new regulations over there that don't affect us just yet, which is that they've put a limit on the percentage of nitromethane that you can use so as to try and get rid of a lot of these massive explosions they've been suffering, because if that type of explosion started to develop here in our country, you could almost see it shut down the sport, because the spectator being so close to the racing creates a lot of danger, and some of the explosions that they had over there towards the end of the season, like I said, that had happened here, it probably would have hospitalised people.
Yeah, it is a major concern which the NHRA and the IHRA took immediate action on.
That's correct. They've stepped straight in and said, well, we're going to stop these major explosions. I hope that the rules they've adopted over there are looked at very closely by our administration, and with some thoughts to introducing them after the Winter Nationals. You couldn't do it mid-season, but I mean, it would give everyone plenty of time then in the big cars to spend the off-season, prepping their tune-ups for the new percentages, because there's a marked slowdown in the cars as far as ET goes. It hasn't affected the speeds. The cars over there at the Winter Nationals are all qualifying in the 460s, but no one's qualifying in the 450s like they thought they would have in the past. They've got cars running 320 odd mile an hour, which was common last year, and they're still running it this year, so it's just the ETs that have slowed down a little bit, and no major explosion.
Yeah, and which is of course one thing that everyone likes to see, because if there's no major explosions on the start line or the burnout, it means they're seeing paired runs down the track.
Well, it's only fair to the spectator, isn't it? Today they're asked to pay a reasonable reward for witnessing the show, and if that show consists of major clean-ups, it's not really a show, is it? And now the guys over there, they actually get fined, but please, I hope they don't introduce that side of it here. Our guys run for such a pittance of prize money that I think you'd see us all give it away if they started bringing in fines if you have an oil down. But over there, they're multi-million dollar contracts, and these guys are supposed to be the experts, so let's just hope that the information that they develop, which preserves engine parts, flows onto our guys here, and will make for better racing.
All right, now you talk about the amounts people are getting paid. That comes down to the promoters, and you are getting closer every time we speak to becoming one of those promoters yourself.
Well, Craig, if you're referring to the Western Sydney Motorplex proposal, I never did want to be a promoter. I've been that in the past in the old Castle Ray days. My only ambition by being involved in this project is to see drag racing become independent from motor circuits, to see drag racing gain its independence in the year 2000, and to have a track that is run totally as a non-profit organisation, whereas the profits that are derived from the drag racing that's held on that site will be returned further into the development of the sport, and I in no way envisage Jim Reid making a lot of money out of it, and hopefully we could persuade Kevin Prendergast to come back here and be our promoter.
All right, now, particularly with that, how the last time we spoke was late last year, you were going to the government about land acquisition.
Yes.
That still hasn't come through as yet, I believe.
Well, just to fill you in, I don't know whether I spoke to you, I can't remember when, I know I spoke to you towards the end of the year. In late October, the Director General of the Premier's Department instructed David Cook and myself to go out and get a detailed costing on what it would cost to to build the independent drag strip, which we did, and we engaged engineers, and we were promised that we would be given an answer the following month. That answer wasn't forthcoming, and then they've turned around and decided that they want to have another independent inquiry into the possibilities of building a parallel straight. Now, this would involve around about $10 million worth of construction, and it would not be able to operate independently from the motor circuit. It would still be a shared basis, and for the life of me, Blind Freddy can tell that that would absolutely be a disaster, because nothing would change from what we've got now, except we'd be possibly allowed to race 30 days of the year, and the sport would not be in control of its own destiny, and it would still have to fit in with other forms of motorsport. To me, that's like building a swimming pool with no water. I mean, it's ridiculous what they're trying to force the issue on at the moment, and we're at loggerheads on that. Just about everybody that I know is laughing at the thought that the government is spending an absolute fortune to try and prove they're right and that they can do it at the moment.
Yeah, and they, in fact, they dragged over a few of the Andrew officials to try and help them with the case, and that fell down. That fell down almost immediately because there wasn't enough land to put a drag racing strip where they wanted to put it.
Well, Craig, just not trying to contradict you there, just understand something. You can build a drag strip on the Hume Highway. You can build one in George Street, Sydney. You can build one in Collins Street, Melbourne. But that doesn't mean it's going to function properly. That doesn't mean it's going to have all of the necessary add-ons that make up a venue that can be profitable and can service the public and create, you know, jobs and give a, you know, an injection of tourism money into the local economy. If it doesn't have all the ingredients that is required, it will be a failure. And what they're actually saying is well, at the moment, well, what we're proposing, Mr. Drag Race, is sit back. We'll build a parallel straight. There will be a 46% reduction in spectator facilities, and we're going to leave the ARDC in charge of your destiny. Well, you go out and tell table tennis that it's in charge of rugby league and see what the rugby league will say, or see what the VFL will say if you tell them, because what they're trying to tell everybody is that, oh, well, it's all motorsport. Well, you know, there's a lot of ball sports around that don't get along either. And most certainly drag racing deserves its own opportunity. It was the biggest crowd puller here in Sydney, and even now we can get between 5,000 and 8,000 people attend a street meet. These people can't put on any of their racing out there and get any crowd at all. So somebody needs to take a long, hard look at, you know, what is the most popular sport.
Yeah, Jim, it's always a pleasure to get you on the show, and we look forward to seeing and hearing how you run down at Calder Park for the Nationals. I know from the sound of it, you're totally focused on this meeting for, well, the best run you've had this year.
We sure are, Craig, and hopefully one of us lucky Aussies will pull off the first 300 mile an hour at this event.
Yeah, hopefully that track will be in top flight for...
I'm sure it will, Craig. They always do an excellent job there of preparing the track, and we're going to be in town a little bit early to have a close look at it. We're doing a thing at the Autobahn store at Sunshine, so you know, if any of the fans down there want to come out and see us before the race, we'll make them welcome.
All right, then. Thanks very much, Jim Reid.
Thanks, Craig.
And elsewhere around the world, things are occurring with the British Touring Car Championship. The calendar's been revised there for their 2000 calendar to avoid clashes between the Toker events and the British Racing Driver Club events. Of course, British Racing Drivers Club running the super production class. As the two have joined together, they've decided to sort of avoid date clashes, and they've actually got a new set of dates that come up. One thing this year, of course, their inaugural visit to Mondello Park's events, because of the fact that the central improvement work hasn't been completed at the circuit. In other news, Scottish sports car driver Alan McNish is going to be driving for Audi at Le Mans this year, and also in the American Le Mans series, so hopefully we'll see him down in Adelaide later in the year, where the word is there as well. We'll maybe seeing the stars of Formula 3, apparently the international drivers who normally compete at Macau, Pau and a number of the other international Formula 3 races have been invited to compete in a race to be held on the old Adelaide Grand Prix circuit as a support event to the American Le Mans Series Race of the Millennium, or Race of the Century, whatever they like to call it, down there in Adelaide over the new year of 2000. Other interesting news, the talk that the British Touring Car Championship may be moved away from Toker in 2002. Apparently the teams have now come out in support of Toker, the fact that they weren't advised, and it looks like things are still up in the air there. In the meantime, the FIA has given sanction to a European Super Touring Cup, which will take place over 10 rounds, 6 rounds to be held in Italy and 4 in other neighbouring countries, including Austria, France, Slovenia and Czechoslovakia. And other items, the British Touring Car Championship guys, of course, they're out doing their testing. And the lucky winner of the Albert Park ride in the McLaren Mercedes with the Cross Australian Grand Prix this year will be driven around by Monaco Grand Prix winner
Olivier
Panis. So that'll be a bit of fun for them there. And I reckon, you know, Olivier Panis will be quite a good run. I'm sure he'd give the people the run for their money in more ways than one. And no doubt he'll probably put on a bit of a show for the people there.
Yeah, he will do indeed. But that's where we've got to wrap it up for this afternoon, this evening. And well, we hope you can all join us next week on Inside Motorsport, Colin.
That's right. And well, I think it's just one very, very quick one, just the tail end. For the people who are World Rally Championship people and have been dying the last couple of years, the fact that you used to have in previous years the compilation videotapes, so if you didn't get to catch all the rounds, last 2 years, because of problems about licensing with the FIA, there hasn't been the compilation tapes, so you could, you know, see the highlights of each round. This year, it's back.
And out now at the Checker Playbook shop.
That's right. It's one of those things from Duke Video, and as always, great viewing, includes the highlights from LA Australia and the rest. So I know I've got mine on order. I'm just waiting for it to turn up.
Yeah, that's right. The Telstra Rally Australia was in fact voted the rally of the year in 1999. We've
again
got to go because we have run our overtime big this week.
Okay, we'll see you all next week.
Inside Motorsport is produced by Thunder Media in the studios of Triple S FM Canberra via Comrade Sat with the support of the Community Broadcasting Association of Australia.
What can you tell me about your parents?